program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Hello, and welcome to Audio Journal's look at history from all points of the globe, a program that reports on what has happened, so we might consequently find out what could happen. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind, and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. I'm Tricia Droney, and for the next hour, we'll explore a variety of topics, including dads in America. Also, learning more about President Jefferson's lavish lifestyle. Also, how the presidential range in New Hampshire got its name and all of the arguing that went on while it was being named. We'll begin with a wonderful article from History.com by Greg Daugherty, written in April of 2026, entitled Why Fads Have Flourished in America. To much of the world, the United States is a country of fads, where fashion crazes, trendy diets, and other fleeting obsessions aren't just a pastime, but a major export. The British invented the word, England's Economics magazine noted in 1986, but there is no place like America for fads, no society where so many can make so much money and others derive such pleasure from a passing fancy. But that wasn't always the case. In the nation's early days, most fads were largely imported from Europe, and most people were too busy scraping out a living to indulge in them. As author Nancy Hendrick writes in Popular Fads and Crazes Through American History, when the American nation was born in the late 1700s, the national pastime was called survival. So what changed? Historians have been asking that question for decades. The Industrial Revolution of the 1800s didn't just transform production. It helped create a market for fads. Fads were far less common, perhaps rare or even non-existent during the pre-industrial period, leisure studies historian John Griffin Donlan writes in the 2009 book Encyclopedia of Recreation and Leisure in America. But industrialization made goods cheaper and faster to produce and easier to promote and spread. At the same time, new communication technologies, from mass circulation magazines to the telegraph and the telephone, helped accelerate that spread. The word fad soon entered the English language. The Oxford English Dictionary calls its origins unknown, but cites examples from as far back as 1834 and 1867. Just as Great Britain led the Industrial Revolution, it, along with France, long dominated the world of fads. That shifted after the First World War, when the U.S. emerged not only as a global power, but as a cultural force, especially in fashion. From the early 17th century until World War I, Americans slavishly imitated fashions from abroad, author and artist Douglas W. Gorseling wrote in his 1952 book, What People Wore, A Visual History of Dress from Ancient Times to 20th Century America. By the 1920s, he added, Paris, New York, and Hollywood had become the three major style centers, with one thing in common, an emphasis on continuous change. While fads and fashions often overlap, scholars distinguish between them. Fashions evolve over time, with one style replacing another, while fads tend to appear suddenly and fade just as quickly. The raccoon coats that were all the rage among 1920s college men might be considered a fad, but they were also a fashion in that later college students still wore coats of some kind. The pet rock fad of the 1970s, on the other hand, came out of nowhere and went back there in short order. Joel Best, professor emeritus of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware, and author of Flavor of the Month, Why Smart People Fall for Fads, sums up a fad's life cycle in three words: emerging, surging, and purging. Fashions, on the other hand, can be visualized as a series of such curves, each overlapping the one before. By the early 20th century, fads had become significant enough to study. In 1914, University of Southern California sociologist Emory Bogardus began tracking them by polling large numbers of students and teachers several times a year about what they had considered the five biggest fads of the moment. Their lists included such soon-forgotten sensations as fake moles on women's cheeks, feathers on men's hats, and the phrase, "Ain't we got fun?" His findings, published a decade later, revealed that about 80% of the fads disappeared within a year, and fewer than 2% lasted 3 years. Those that endured, like men's wristwatches and tortoise-shell glasses, were probably not fads at all, and many innovations first dismissed as fads, from bicycles to television, ultimately proved to have staying power. The 1920s, often characterized as the Roaring Twenties in the U.S., became a fertile period for fads. Passing national obsessions ranged from the Charleston and Mahjong to endurance spectacles like dance marathons, chair-rocking contests, and flagpole sitting. Most of these fads originated with the era's flaming youth, who were eager to break with their parents' taboos and traditions. But those same fads often trickled up to their elders, at least those who weren't easily embarrassed. A 1926 magazine cover by a famous cartoonist of the era, John Held, Jr., showed a young flapper dancing the Charleston with a tuxedoed gent old enough to be her grandfather. Both seemed to be enjoying themselves. Not for nothing did the 1920s come to be called the era of wonderful nonsense. Americans had less appetite for nonsense, wonderful or otherwise, with the arrival of the Great Depression and the Second World War. But the nation didn't completely give up on fads, especially those offering a sense of hope or escape. Chain letters surged in 1935 with the send-a-dime scheme, as millions mailed coins to strangers hoping other strangers would soon be sending many more back to them. Eating contests in which competitors gorged themselves drew crowds, even as many spectators struggled to put food on their own tables. In 1939, goldfish swallowing became a brief fad on college campuses. Even World War II didn't entirely dampen the fad trend. Women took up leg painting when stockings became scarce, while teenage bobby soxers became known for both their footwear and their habit of swooning over singers like Frank Sinatra. The 1940s also marked the introduction of the word teenager and their ascendance as a distinct cultural and economic force. Soldiers joined in as well, most notably by scrawling, "Kilroy was here," accompanied by a cartoon of Kilroy on walls and military equipment wherever they went. The post-war years brought new prosperity to the U.S., along with a baby boom that added some 76 million young people to the population between 1945 and 1964. It wasn't long before they became a driving force behind the nation's trends. In 1955, many children became obsessed with Davy Crockett, a 19th-century frontiersman turned TV hero by Walt Disney. Coonskin caps, usually fake fur, and a flood of related merchandise followed, while the show's theme song spawned multiple hit records, reportedly selling some 10 million copies. Fads used to be started by young adults and then spread up and down to older and younger people, Landon Jones writes in his 1980 chronicle, Great Expectations, America and the Baby Boom Generation. But the fads of the 50s were creations of the children. They flowed up. He attributed the shift to both the boomers' sheer numbers and the growing influence of television and advertising. Like many fads, Crockett mania faded in less than a year, only to be replaced by other fads. Later in the 1950s, boomers drove crazes for hula hoops, pogo sticks, sea monkeys, and a talkative doll known as Chatty Cathy. In the 1960s, as many boomers reached their teens, their music and dances, think fads like the Watusi and the mashed potato, dominated popular culture, injected into the zeitgeist by new TV shows like American Bandstand. The decade's biggest dance craze, The Twist, cut across generational and class lines. Even the otherwise dignified First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy, made headlines in 1962 when she danced it with Defense Secretary Robert McNamara at a White House soiree. In the decades that followed, boomers would be linked to such fads as streaking, disco, shag carpets, waterbeds, fern bars, and eventually pickleball. As boomers began to have children, new fads followed. While no generation is homogeneous and many overlap, each has left its own imprint. Generation X, born roughly between 1965 and 1980, turned Transformers and Cabbage Patch Kids into must-have toys, revived skateboarding, and embraced new sounds like grunge and hip-hop. Gen Xers found a fresh way to consume their music, the music video, earning yet another nickname, the MTV generation. Millennials, 1981 to 1996, may be forever associated with faddish phenomenon like Pokemon cards, Beanie Babies, and rollerblading, and later emojis, body piercing, and avocado toast. Members of Generation Z, 1997 to 2012, have been linked to Bratz dolls, TikTok challenges, cottagecore, and micro tattoos. Younger cohorts, sometimes labeled Generation Alpha, born between 2010 and 2024, and Generation Beta, 2025 to 2039, are only beginning to make their mark, but are likely to continue the American tradition of creating and abandoning fads. Given America's long infatuation with the latest thing, fads seem here to stay, even if any particular one isn't. They extend well beyond pop culture, cycling through academia, business, team-building exercises, anyone, and even science and medicine. What has changed is the speed at which fads spread, driven by advances in communication. In 1970, futurist Alvin Toffler argued that fads could explode on the scene virtually overnight and vanish just as quickly, fueled by the well-oiled machinery of marketing and media. That was a half a century before TikTok and Instagram. We're a country that was established on the principle that we were going to try something new, says Best. Americans are open to change. We have an ideology of progress. That openness may be rooted in the nation's cultural makeup. In comparison with other societies, we are such an amalgamation of cultures, says Janet Scherzan, a nutritional anthropologist at the University of Pennsylvania and co-author of Anxious Eaters, Why We Fall for Fad Diets. We're largely an immigrant society, lacking the clear rules of a country like France. In that kind of environment, new fads are all but inevitable. Greg Daugherty of History.com continues with a separate article about fads entitled Radium, the Deadly Health Fad of the Early 1900s. In 1903, after Pierre and Marie Curie and fellow scientist Henri Becquerel received the Nobel Prize in Physics for their discoveries involving radioactive substances, the world seemed on the verge of a miraculous new era in medicine. But when an enterprising newspaper reporter asked Marie Curie about the potential use of radium to cure or prevent disease, she refused to speculate. "Why, I do not know," she answered. "How can I tell? I'm not aware that anything in that direction has been actually demonstrated." If Marie Curie was hesitant to get ahead of that science, many others weren't. In 1904, the makers of quack remedies and bogus medical devices were touting the radioactive element radium, which the Curies had discovered in 1898 as a cure for just about everything. One widely advertised portion called Eczine, E-C-Z-I-N-E, billed as the wonderful new radium cure, but recently revealed by science, claimed to positively and permanently cure a list of ailments that included eczema, pimples, ringworm, and blood poison. The company promised a $50 reward to any purchaser whose eczema somehow remained uncured. In Buffalo, an advertiser offered radium-charged water, calling it the greatest discovery of the 20th century, and asserting that it cures all diseases. Readers were invited to come by for a free drink. Meanwhile, newspaper ads in the upper Midwest promoted the new radium light cure, capable of curing every kind of human ill, with results so great and wonderful that it was hard indeed to find the dividing line between human accomplishment and miracle. Many of these supposed remedies were touted by doctors or purported doctors. One, for example, advertised himself as Rupert Wells, M.D., professor of therapeutics in the Postgraduate College of Electromedical Therapeutics, St. Louis, Missouri. Wells claimed he had an absolutely certain cure for cancer, consumption, and thousands of lesser diseases, almost in a night. With possibly unintentional humor, he insisted that, quote, "my heart glows with pride and gratitude as I think of it." Wells' ad urged readers to send for a free book, Radium in the Cure of Disease, which touted the benefits of his elixir Radol, complete with testimonials from people who have been cured by its use. Radol and its creator, Wells, whose real name was apparently Dennis Dupuy, figured prominently in one of the series of exposés in Collier's magazine by investigative journalist Samuel Hopkins Adams, later collected in his book, The Great American Fraud. Adams called Dupuy the fake professor of a mythical chair in a purely imaginary college whose, quote, remedy, Radol, contained exactly as much radium as dishwater does. In fact, it's unlikely any of these products contained any actual radium. Because of the laborious process required to mine and refine radium, it was incredibly expensive, reportedly selling in early 1904 for $8.4 million a pound, compared with about $300 for a pound of gold. Unfortunately, a few radioactive remedies did contain some measure of radium. The most notorious example may have been Radithor, a concoction of radium-laced distilled water sold in half-ounce bottles of $1 a pop, close to $19 now. The man behind Radithor was a mail-order promoter and convicted fraudster named William Bailey, who referred to himself as Dr. Bailey, despite his lack of a medical degree. Bailey offered an array of products that claimed to use radiation to cure all manner of ills, including thorone tablets that purported to be 250 times more radioactive than radium, and the Radiondoctrinator, a small metal box that initially sold for $1,000 at a time when you could buy a new 1924 Model T Ford for under $300. Bailey's pitch for the pricey device was that it could somehow revitalize the body's endocrine glands, curing everything from acidosis to diabetes, from pimples to poor memory. The pioneering consumer advocate Arthur Callett and F.J. Schlink wrote in their 1932 book, 100,000 Guinea Pigs, Dangers in Everyday Foods, Drugs, and Cosmetics. The Radiondoctrinator seemed to have been of particular interest to men worried about their waning sexual powers. They were instructed to wear the device to bed at night, positioned with a special athletic strap. But as Callett and Schlink write, Bailey's supreme masterpiece was Radithor. While it was directed chiefly to wealthy but jaded individuals seeking a remedy for sexual impotence or venereal disease, it also made claims of curative worth in 160 other afflictions. Ruth DeForest Lamb wrote of Radithor in her 1936 book, American Chamber of Horrors, The Truth About Food and Drugs. The minimum course of treatment was 3 to 5 months, a half-ounce bottle to be taken every day in the average condition, but 2 or 3 in severe or chronic cases. Because of its cost and the number of bottles required to effect a cure, Radithor was out of reach for many consumers of modest means, and lucky for them. Not so lucky was Eben Byers, a Pittsburgh millionaire who'd made a national name for himself as the U.S. amateur golf champion in 1906. Byers could afford as much Radiothor as he wanted, and starting in late 1927, he managed to gulp down multiple bottles each day for more than 3 years, probably some 1,000 to 1,500 bottles in all, according to Roger Maclis, writing in Scientific American magazine. He even gave it to some of his racehorses, Maclis reports. By the time Byers realized that Radiothor was doing him more harm than good, it was too late. He died of radium poisoning in early 1932 at age 51, but not before his almost unimaginable suffering had drawn national attention and calls to ban the, quote, cure that killed him. Time magazine quoted a government attorney who had visited him months before his death. He could hardly speak. His head was swathed in bandages. He had undergone two successive operations in which his whole upper jaw, excepting two front teeth, and most of his lower jaw had been removed. All the remaining bone tissue of his body was slowly disintegrating, and holes were actually forming in his skull. An autopsy later revealed that his bones contained more than three times the amount of radium considered fatal. Because of a loophole in the law, none of Bailey's outrageous claims actually appeared on the product's packaging, the Food and Drug Administration couldn't halt the sale of Radiothor, but the Federal Trade Commission was eventually able to curtail its advertising. By then, however, Bailey had cashed out and moved on to new ventures, including the BioRay, said to irradiate entire rooms of the home, and the AdrenoRay, a supposedly radioactive belt meant to stimulate the adrenal glands atop the kidneys. Throughout the 1910s and well into the 20s and 30s, the list of radioactive health products with or without any actual radium grew. An outfit called the Radior Company Limited of England sold a line of radioactive toiletries through American drug and department stores as early as 1918, all guaranteed to retain their radioactivity for at least 20 years. Offerings included face creams, powders, hair tonic, and bar soap. A 1919 Radior ad explained the alleged benefits of radium. It's a source of never-dying energy, which vitalizes tissue, eliminates blemishes, tones up glands and muscles, and brings back the rounded contours, rosy color, and soft, firm texture of youth. Callett and Schlink noted that by 1929, consumers could buy everything from mouthwashes to chocolate bars, all supposedly delivering the miraculous benefits of radiation. Many manufacturers around the world added the word radium to their brands simply to give them an added glow in products from beer to butter to cigars, even if they rarely contained any actual radium. Shoppers in what is now the Czech Republic could buy radium bread, which apparently contained at least a trace of it from the local water. Marie Curie's own death at 66 from aplastic anemia was generally attributed to radiation exposure, but her work also led to legitimate, often life-saving medical treatments, some of which remain standard today. Radium isotopes are still used in certain stages of treatment for prostate cancer, and more broadly, radiation therapy is often a mainstay in cancer treatment, notes Dr. Lydia Kang, co-author of Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything, written in 2017. She underscores, however, that radiation remains dangerous to patient and providers alike if not properly handled. Even physicians with the best intention in the early 1900s were taking a leap of faith in using radium to treat their patients. Now that we're in 2025, we've had a lot of time to figure this out, Kang says. Back then it was, let's try this and see what happens. Our next article is from the New England Historical Society. It's entitled, How the Presidential Range Got Its Names and Started a Bunch of Arguments. In the 19th century, New Hampshire went into a frenzy of naming the White Mountains, from Attitash, the Indian name for blueberries, to Zealand. No one knows why. That changed in 1890 when the federal government began tightening control over the haphazard naming of geographic features, much to the displeasure of those with their own ideas about naming the presidential range. Controversies over the names of New Hampshire's tallest mountains began in the 19th century, continued into the 21st century. They may well go on into the 22nd. The White Mountains. Though Maine and Vermont have their share of mountain peaks, the Whites are the most intensely mapped and hiked in New England. They have the highest concentration of named summits, including 48 4,000-foot peaks. Maine only has 14 4,000-footers, Vermont 5. Massachusetts and Connecticut don't have any 4,000-footers, and you can forget about Rhode Island. Its highest peak is the 812-footer Jeremoth Hill in Foster, though some joke its highest peak is the 550-foot Landfill in Johnston. The New Hampshire Presidential Range, located mostly in northernmost Coos County, has the tallest of the tall peaks. The 13 presidentials include 8 14,000-footers. They also boast the highest mountain in the Northeast, Mount Washington. The 6,288.2-footer got its name during the earliest days of White Mountain exploration. In 1784, two prominent intellectuals, Jeremy Belknap and Manasseh Cutler, climbed Mount Washington. Cutler was the first to publish the name Mount Washington in his report on the expedition. Belknap used it in 1792 in the third volume of his History of New Hampshire. Even then, the naming of the mountain stirred up controversy. 32 years later, Dr. Jacob Bigelow led another expedition to the mountaintop. The party left behind a note in a bottle inscribed with the Abenaki name for the mountain, Mount Agiokook Conquerod. "We leave this behind," the note said. The name Washington, however, pretty much inoculates a geographic feature against a challenge, and so Mount Washington kept its name. By 1820, the civic leaders of Lancaster, New Hampshire, decided to have a party naming the rest of the mountains in the presidential range. Tourists had begun to travel to the White Mountains by then. The Crawford family, after whom the notch is named, began it all in 1790 when they moved to the Whites and started building inns. On July 31st, 1820, the Lancaster men began their journey. They hired Ethan Allen Crawford, the son of the Crawford family patriarch, as their guide. Then they loaded their baggage on a Crawford like a pack mule and added their coats as they started to climb the mountains. When they reached the summit of Mount Washington, they began to name the surrounding mountains. They named the second highest mountain after the second president, John Adams, the third highest after Thomas Jefferson. Then they named the fifth highest peak after James Madison and the fourth highest by 5 feet after James Monroe, the current president. But they'd run out of presidents. So they named the sixth highest peak after someone of presidential stature, Mount Franklin, after Ben. They still had another mountain to name, so they called it Mount Pleasant. The Lancaster men included among their provisions an adult beverage called Oh Be Joyful. They eponymously toasted the mountains and the statesmen they'd named them after. By the mid-19th century, painters and writers took to the mountains to ply their trades. In the process, they promoted tourism to the Whites. Nathaniel Hawthorne visited, wrote a short story, The Great Stone Face, and got a brook and a waterfall named after himself. Benjamin Champney often painted the White Mountains and founded an artist colony in North Conway, New Hampshire. He got a brook and a trail named after him on Mount Chocora. Artist Brook and Artist Falls took their names from artists who painted their splendor. However, the falls became a favorite subject not because of their splendor, but because they were easy to get to. Throughout the mid-19th century, the Whites hosted geologists like Charles Hitchcock, cartographers like Philip Carrigan, and botanists like Edward Tuckerman. They gave their own names and others to the mountain's geographic features. One almost president who actually climbed the White Mountains got one named after him, Daniel Webster. Thomas Starr King, in 1859, wrote a White Mountain guidebook packed with bombast. The White Hills, their legends, landscapes, and poetry, served up such grandiloquence as the richest feasts of loveliness and grandeur are spread by the summer around the valleys. King paid a visit to the Presidential Range, and he noticed Mount Adams had three peaks. In his book, he named the second peak after the seventh president, John Quincy Adams. The name stuck. In 1876, MIT professor Edward Charles Pickering and entomologist Samuel Hubbard Scudder sent invitations to their academic friends to join their new organization, the Appalachian Mountain Club. The goal? To map the White Mountains, create trails, and build campsites and shelters. They also established a committee on nomenclature to study mountain names. AMC members got started right away by jokingly referring to the third peak on Mount Adams as Sam Adams. That name stuck too. It seemed anyone could name any of the White Mountains. If a name spread by word of mouth in nearby towns, it would stick. The U.S. government had no formal organization or protocol for naming peaks. Finally, the willy-nilly naming of geographical features ended. In 1890, President Benjamin Harrison issued an executive order creating the Board on Geographic Names as the standard authority on all unsettled questions about geographic names. Harrison did not get a peak named after him for his troubles. Others who did, but not in the presidential range, include Abraham Lincoln, James Garfield, Calvin Coolidge, and Grover Cleveland. The presidential range does have a Mount Jackson, but named in 1848 after New Hampshire state geologist Charles T. Jackson, not President Andrew Jackson. But a town that lies in the shadow of the presidential range does bear the seventh president's name. Adams was originally named after John Adams in 1800, but his son, John Quincy, fought two bitter battles for the presidency with Andrew Jackson. John Quincy won the first election but lost the second in 1828. The town of Adams, presumably a hotbed of Jacksonian democracy, voted in 1829 to change its name to Jackson. The Board on Geographic Names may have thought it had the last word on geographic names, but it has had to think again. In 1913, the New Hampshire State Legislature renamed one of the presidential mountains. It named Mount Clinton after New York Governor DeWitt Clinton after Franklin Pierce, the only U.S. president born in New Hampshire. The governing board went along with the Mount Pierce, but the AMC did not. Perhaps because of its contempt for Pierce's dismal presidency, the AMC continued to publish maps calling the mountain Mount Clinton. In 1969, former President Dwight D. Eisenhower died. His assistant and former New Hampshire governor, Sherman Adams, lobbied for a Mount Eisenhower in the presidential range. The legislature tossed out Mount Pleasant and brought in Mount Eisenhower. In 1970, the board put its stamp of approval on the change. The legislature then, in 2003, passed a law that said Mount Clay, named after presidential candidate Henry Clay, shall hereafter be called and known as Mount Reagan. The board refused to make the change. New Hampshire state documents continue to refer to the mountain formerly known as Clay as Mount Reagan. As late as 2000, two minor subpeaks of Mount Adams still didn't have names. With one subpeak named Quincy and the other Sam, the governing board in 2010 agreed to name one Mount Abigail Adams. The other remains Adams 5. Perhaps fans of Clover, Henry, Brooks, Mitch, or the two Charles Francis Adams would like to lobby the board for one of their names just to keep it in the family. The board eventually moved to the Department of the Interior, and in the 60s and 70s, it began to eliminate the use of derogatory terms for Japanese, Black, and Indigenous people. President Donald Trump gave it a new task in his 2025 executive order, restoring names that honor American greatness. Now, from learning about the presidential mountains and the naming after presidents, let's take a look at President Thomas Jefferson in an article entitled Jefferson's Lavish Lifestyle and Struggle with Debt. This was written in 2025, May 28th. Thomas Jefferson was many things during his long and accomplished life: founding father, U.S. president, ambassador to France, architect, author, farmer, inventor, violinist, and all-around Renaissance man. Through it all, he was also something else, an incorrigible shopaholic saddled with debt. Jefferson inherited not one but two large estates, his father's and his father-in-law's, and earned a respectable income of his own from a variety of ventures. Even so, when he died at age 83 in 1826, he left behind debts in excess of $100,000, well over $1 million in today's dollars, according to historian and biographer John Meacham. Where did all the money go? Pretty much everywhere. Jefferson amassed an unparalleled book collection and stocked his cellar with the choicest European wines. He poured a fortune into building and then remodeling his Virginia mansion, Monticello, a money pit if there ever was one. He entertained lavishly, even when uninvited strangers came to call, and was unfailingly generous to friends and relatives, taking on their debts in some instances, which only exacerbated his own. At the same time, he adamantly opposed allowing the young United States to accumulate a national debt, putting him at odds with the country's first Treasury Secretary and his ideological foe, Alexander Hamilton, a man Jefferson utterly loathed, according to biographer Joseph Ellis. In fact, Ellis writes, Jefferson declared that eliminating the national debt was the highest priority of his presidency. Ellis and other Jefferson scholars speculate that the crushing burdens of Jefferson's own debts played a large part in his aversion to governmental debt, while having little effect on his personal spending. As Meacham writes, Jefferson's capacity to live with contradictions was nothing less than epic. Thomas Jefferson was born into wealth in April 1743. Both his parents descended from prosperous Virginia planters. As the eldest son of eight surviving children, Jefferson stood to collect the largest share of the family's wealth. When his father died in 1757, Jefferson inherited some 5,000 acres of land and more than 20 enslaved people. Because he was just 14 at the time, the property was held in trust for him until he turned 21. In the meantime, Jefferson attended college at William & Mary, studied law, and began to show an interest in politics. Among his inherited holdings was a small mountaintop where Jefferson envisioned building a mansion of his own design. He called Monticello for Little Mountain. Construction began in 1769, and Jefferson moved in the following year, even before its completion. He built and rebuilt it, working intermittently over 28 years, with costs varying each year depending on the ambition of his latest addition. The degree to which unpaid labor was used, whether materials were bartered, and more. Between March 4, 1802 and March 4, 1803 alone, Jefferson tallied building costs, including workmen's salaries, building materials, and other miscellaneous items, of $3,587.92, more than $100,000 in today's dollars. Monticello was also the name of his plantation, which grew wheat, tobacco, and other crops. Even before the Revolution, that business began accruing debt to the Scottish firm that bought his tobacco. One way he worked to address his debt was to leverage the monetary value of the enslaved men and women he owned by using them as collateral to borrow money. The Monticello we see today was built with a slave equity loan Jefferson obtained from a Dutch banking house, says Henry Weenick, author of Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves. As Jefferson rose through a succession of increasingly important political and diplomatic offices, minister to France, secretary of state, vice president, and ultimately president, he continued to dig himself deeper into debt. His interlude abroad had not only pulled his attention away from managing the plantation, it introduced him to the finer things in European life and apparently allowed plenty of free time for shopping. Generally considered America's first great wine connoisseur, Jefferson spent $7,500, more than $200,000 today, on mostly French and Italian bottles in his first presidential term alone, including hundreds of bottles of champagne, Lafitte, Coem, and more. Mark Leibson, author of Saving Monticello, A History of the State, discovered that Jefferson shipped 86 crates of his other French finds back to Monticello, including furniture, silverware, glassware, china, wallpaper, fabrics, book, portraits, and other works of art. As a gentleman of high stature and refined taste, Jefferson gravitated to items by the most renowned artists and craftsmen. More costly still, he'd become enamored of French architecture and decided to remodel Monticello accordingly. That project, begun in 1796, would double the mansion's size as well as add its distinctive dome, reportedly the first in America. Monticello II, as it is often called, was finished in 1809, although Jefferson, being Jefferson, continued to tinker with it for the rest of his life. Outside the mansion, he turned Monticello's ground into a curated decorative park and his fields into laboratories of sometimes pricey experimentation. His gardens alone were planted with more than 300 varieties of more than 90 different plants, including 15 kinds of peas. Many were exotic at the time, such as chickpeas and sea kale. He thought nothing of importing seeds and fruit trees from abroad, including olive trees from Italy and France and orange trees from Spain, the latter of which had to be moved inside during winter. His extensive and failed efforts to import and cultivate European wine grapes also proved costly. Unfortunately, when his presidency also came to an end in 1809, Jefferson estimated that he was in even greater debt than before. Like other presidents before him and many others after, Jefferson wasn't entitled to a government pension. That wouldn't change until 1958 with the passage of the former President's Act. So in retirement, Jefferson had to find other ways to support his family and repay his debts. He hoped to pay his debts with his farming and business ventures, Leibson told History.com in an interview. Unfortunately, he wasn't very good at either farming or business. Jefferson's personal extravagance wasn't entirely to blame for his situation. When his father-in-law, John Wales, died in the early 1770s, the future president inherited not only 11,000 acres and 135 enslaved individuals, but a large chunk of Wales' debts, which he now needed to repay along with his own. And in 1818, he co-signed a $20,000 note for a friend who died 2 years later, leaving Jefferson saddled with even more debt. While Jefferson might have been able to rationalize his debts earlier, as he approached the end of his life, he worried increasingly about how they would burden his heirs. In 1815, he sold the bulk of his precious library, more than 6,000 volumes, to the government for $23,950, using much of the proceeds to settle two key debts. The collection would help rebuild the Library of Congress, which had been torched by British troops in the War of 1812. Soon after selling off his books, Jefferson, of course, began buying more. "I cannot live without books," he explained in a letter to John Adams, his predecessor as president and an on-again, off-again friend. In 1826, desperate to find a way to ease his heirs' burden, Jefferson had a novel idea, a lottery in which Monticello would be first prize. The Virginia legislature, which had to approve the arrangement, at first balked, then relented. The plan was to sell about 11,480 tickets at $10 each, but the lottery ended up being postponed, and Jefferson died that July 4th before it could happen. At the time of his death, Jefferson's debts were calculated at $107,000, a substantial sum for the time. To help pay them off, Jefferson heirs put many of his household possessions, his livestock, and some 130 enslaved persons up for auction in early 1827. As part of his will, he had previously freed 5 enslaved men, all members of the same family. Disposing of Monticello proved more difficult, especially because it had fallen into disrepair. Initially, according to Leibson, the family hoped to get as much as $20,000 for it, but the house sat on the market until 1831, finally selling, along with 552 acres of land, for just $7,000 to James Turner Barclay, a local pharmacist. Jefferson had named his eldest grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, executor of his estate, leaving him the unenviable job of settling his debts. Randolph devoted his own life to the task, but when he died in his 80s, in 1875, it remained unfinished. It was only with the settlement of Randolph's own estate that the debts were completely erased. The year was 1878, more than half a century after Thomas Jefferson's death. In recognition of April 15th, our National Tax Day, this next article is relevant. It's written by Leslie Kennedy of History.com in April of 2026, in fact, April 15th, Tax Day, entitled, How Tax Day Turned Into Party Night at the Post Office. In 20th century America, last-minute filers weren't just rushing to the post office to make the tax day deadline. Many were heading to a party. Before electronic filing became common, millions of Americans went to their local postal branch with their paper returns on April 15th. Many post offices stayed open until midnight, and crowds were large enough and stuck in line long enough that radio stations, fast food chains, marching bands, and even Playboy turned Tax Day into a marketing opportunity. Paul Smith, a United States Post Office spokesman who has worked for the service for more than 40 years, recalls massive lines of cars pulling up to his Philadelphia branch on Tax Day. Employees carried buckets, walking up to the cars to take customers' forms to keep traffic moving and spirits high. It was all just very, very festive, he said. Modern tax filing began in 1913, when the 16th Amendment created the federal income tax and the government introduced Form 1040. For most of the 20th century, taxpayers completed paper forms and mailed them in. Across the country, post offices became mini street fairs on April 15th, the deadline for filing since 1955. In Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Smith recalls, a Dunk the IRS agent booth where taxpayers could throw balls to plunge a friendly revenue officer into a tank of water. A 1992 St. Petersburg Times article described a similar booth in Florida, with filers paying $1 to dunk off-duty IRS agents to raise money for charity and allow a few taxpayers filing last-minute returns to vent their anger. In Belmar, New Jersey, Smith said filers were treated to a huge balloon arch as they drove to the collection box. In Philadelphia, he adds, employees from nearby Atlantic City casinos dressed as dice or playing cards to hand out vouchers. And then there was Playboy. Smith remembers two women from the company showing up at his Philadelphia branch, hoping to offer massages to people in line to relieve tax day stress. I said, I don't think the government is ready for a Postal Service Playboy partnership, he told them. However, legally, you would be permitted up to such a point, pointing to a map of the grounds. Hours later, a cable truck arrived and unveiled a sparkling pink Playboy booth. You can't make this stuff up, he says. The corporate promotions didn't stop there. A 1999 Associated Press report described dozens of branches across the nation offering free food, music from barbershop quartets, local bands and schools, free scratch-off lottery tickets in Virginia, and even screen tests for the Got Milk campaign in Laguna Beach, California. A radio station in Bridgman, Michigan, will offer aspirin to tax filers in that community, while in Pittsburgh, a local drugstore chain is providing samples of the antacid Mylanta, the AP reported. Elsewhere, Uncle Sam appeared at various post offices in Connecticut, Florida, Pennsylvania, Texas, and West Virginia. One long-standing tax day tradition took place in Lawrence, Kansas. According to a 2011 New York Times article, the Alfred Packer Memorial String Band performed at the post office for decades, playing the William Tell Overture as last-minute filers headed inside. Usually on tax day, people are so blah, but people were dancing and singing and having fun, Postmaster Judy Rainey told the newspaper. And in New York City in the 2000s, the sidewalk outside the James Farley Post Office became what one New York Times writer called, quote, our own Corps de Miracles, or Court of Miracles, filled with activists, street performers, and costume marketers, including people who put a bed on the street to advertise a hotel. As technology changed, tax day parties faded, e-filing became available in 1986, though adoption was slow. But by 2011, more than three-quarters of Americans were filing electronically, according to IRS data, and fewer post offices were staying open late on tax day. By 2025, roughly 94% of Americans filed their individual tax returns online, the service reports. Still, Smith says, it's fun to remember the tax day party era. People were so creative with all the giveaways and the radio station broadcasting live all day from the post office, he says. It was quite a memorable time. And now to end on something a little more lighthearted, National Geographic's An Uncommon History of Common Things by Bethane Patrick and John Thompson. This would be the history of crossing your fingers. Gesture of good luck or superstition typically done in private or behind the back, also spoken, as in, I'll cross my fingers for you. Who hasn't at some point crossed their fingers for good luck? At sports events, before tests and job interviews, even for someone's health. The crossing of fingers is probably, after praying, the most widely used superstitious gesture in the Western world. It's so easy to do, and it can't hurt. Even a simple, I'll keep my fingers crossed for you, will suffice, whether you actually do it or not. The practice comes from Western Europe during the days of paganism. Long before Christianity, the cross was a powerful symbol, signifying perfect unity. It was thought that good spirits resided at the intersection of the cross. Early Europeans believed that a wish made in the presence of a cross was secured at that intersection until the wish came true. The original crossing of fingers was a gesture made by not one, but two people. They formed the cross by placing their index fingers together at right angles. In this way, the wish for luck was a kind of spell between them, where one would wish for some advantageous outcome for the other person. Over time, people realized they could get similar benefits by crossing their own fingers, one index finger over the other, at the second knuckle. A further modification resulted in what we use today, the middle finger crossing over the index finger to form a St. Andrew's cross. For something really important, people cross the fingers of both hands. Crossed fingers have been used in history and not only for luck, but to avoid bad luck or to stop what one says from coming true. At some point, the gesture became appropriated by children as a way of blamelessly telling a lie. Hiding the crossed fingers behind one's back was a way of protecting the fibber from the evil consequences of fibbing. Young people today sometimes hook fingers in order to express agreement or nonverbally seal a deal. The practice comes from the earliest finger crossing. And as a little addendum, uncommonly known, V for victory Winston Churchill is credited with popularizing this two-finger sign of courage during World War II. He may have gotten it from a Belgian radio announcer who frequently played the opening notes of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which mimics the Morse code for the letter V. President George H.W. Bush flashed the V one morning while jogging and told reporters it was Julius Caesar ordering five beers. As we wind up, just a reminder that coming up next at 4 p.m. is Backyard Bookshelf. At 5, AJ Sports Page, that would be Audio Journal Sports Page. At 6 p.m., stay tuned for Science Journal. At 7, Telegram and Gazette. At 8 p.m., USA Today, followed by 9 o'clock, the Boston Globe, 10 p.m., Backyard Bookshelf Archives, and also the same at 11, more Backyard Bookshelf Archives. Also, a reminder that there's a number of ways to listen to Audio Journal broadcasts. You can listen live by streaming live from our own website at audiojournal.org, or listen on your phone through Zeno Media. Call 1-712-770-1043. I'm just going to repeat that. Call Zeno Media at 1-712-770-1043. And you can also listen with cable TV. On your local cable TV station, check our list to find your town. Again, at audiojournal.org/listening with cable TV. Have you received a special receiver from us yet? Please give us a call. We can send you a receiver that you can tune in to Audio Journal's frequency, supplied at no cost to our listeners. If you need one, give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email us at info@audiojournal.org. Then there's always the smart speaker. Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn, or hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or, don't forget, you can listen to us on your smartphone. Find Audio Journal on the Zeno Radio app at apps.apple.com. And finally, oh no, you missed your favorite program? No problem. Look for our podcast on our website at audiojournal.org/locally produced programs. You've been listening to All Things History, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call us at 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Tricia Droney, and if you're a history buff, please know we'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas on an interesting topic for us to investigate. Thanks so much for listening this afternoon.
are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.